Welcome to The Lob by These Football Times, the home of long-form storytelling online. Let us loop you through the ages of football. So sit back, learn, and enjoy the podcast.
Hi everyone, welcome to The Lob podcast from These Football Times. My name is Omar Salim. I'm the editor of the site and I'm your host today. This is an Irish football special, talking about some of the challenges in the domestic game in Ireland and in Northern Ireland. So we recruited three excellent experts from Ireland and from Northern Ireland. So first up, we've got Colin Miller, who's been featured in Northern Ireland Football Daily, writes for the site regularly, also featured in The Mirror and Belfast Live. Hi, Colin. How you doing?
Hi, Omar. I'm not too bad. Thanks so much for having me on.
Great. Connor Kelly, who is a writer for These Football Times as well. It also featured on UMaxit. It's got a weekly column there, featured on 442, and we'll be doing actually some of the Ireland previews for 442 ahead of the Euros. Connor's also part of the Final Third podcast, which if you guys haven't listened to is one of the best out there. It's fantastic. Connor and some of his mates just talking about all different areas of the game, and yeah, do check it out. How you doing, Connor? Good?
Yeah, man, I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
No problem at all. And finally, I said it before, the king of These Football Times, Matt Galt. He's written for the site for a long, long time now. One of the best writers out there, without question. Featured on The Guardian, 442, World Soccer, and is editor of Square Eye TV. So, how you doing, Matt?
Hey, Omar. How you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. Great. All right, we'll jump in straight away. Obviously, we wanted to discuss the challenges facing Irish football. I think they're numerous and they're quite vast. So in an hour's podcast, we'll probably only scratch the surface. But let's try and look at the key issues. We'll talk about them, some of the key figures in the game, League of Ireland, player development. And then we'll maybe look ahead to the Euros with the Ireland national team and Northern Ireland. So let me start with you, Colin. I wanted to find out why. I've been asked this question a lot before. We actually featured an article on it in These Football Times, looking at the decline in the players at the top end of the Premier League, Irish players at the top end of the Premier League. Obviously, if you go back to the Arsenal in the 80s, they had so many players from Ireland, Northern Ireland, Liverpool too, when they won the leagues. Manchester United with Roy Keane, Dennis Irwin, outstanding players. Colin, why do you think that there has been a decline in the number of these players at the top end of the Premier League?
Well, Omar, I mean, you mentioned there, sort of late 80s, early 90s, and that had been a sort of continuing of a tradition for the top clubs in England and Scotland to have a lot of Irish players from both sides of the border coming through their youth systems, getting into their first team squads, and really becoming legends at those clubs. Obviously, you're looking 20, 30 years ago, there certainly wasn't the volume of foreign imports that there would be these days. There wasn't the same amount of money available to the clubs in terms of going out and splashing it on foreign players from outside the UK and Ireland. So there was a lot more opportunity. First of all, that's just a very sort of logical way to look at it in terms of, you know, it was a lot more convenient for the clubs to be bringing those players through. You know, they were probably relatively cheap in terms of playing football and getting contracts sorted, and also of sorting them out with settling into the club. You know, it's a sort of a culture tradition. It's pretty much the same as they would have been brought up in at home. So I think in terms of that was a lot easier for those players to sort of come through. And these days you obviously still have the players being scouted at youth levels and being signed by the academies, but what's happening now is that you have these 18, 19-year-olds released en masse as soon as they reach the under-21 teams, and the clubs are starting to think, like, these players don't quite have the quality that we want, that we need. Yet we can sort of, you know, we can undercut that by going abroad, by you know, scouting around the world, across Europe, and finding players who would either you know be a reasonably good value or otherwise, but they would see that for our club and for getting into our first team, for improving our chances, they would obviously be the preference. So I think that's the sort of the main practical reason behind it, which obviously in itself doesn't point to any sort of lack of quality or any decline as such in terms of Irish and Northern Irish footballers. Just looking at it in that sort of cold light of day, and again, that's something that looks set to continue. It's a trend that you know, there's no reason why that will stop. The only reason that would be is if players would no longer want to come over and play for these top clubs in England and Scotland, if they were to be offered more money at home. But at that, for the time being, it doesn't. There's no signs of that slowing down, even if compared to a few years ago. Manchester United would have had 4 or 5 regular either Irish or Northern Irish players in their first team squad, which is not, of course, no longer the case. Obviously, Paddy McNair is still about for how much longer, nobody really knows. But maybe if he had been 5 or 10 years previous to this, he might have maybe had a better chance of nailing down a long-term future at the club as Johnny Evans did. But again, you're talking, Paddy McNair and Johnny Evans, as two examples, are outstanding Northern Irish footballers in terms of the national team. They're both highly important. There would be two of the first names on the team sheet these days. And, you know, that's the sort of the problem we have then, is a lot of the first team regulars for Northern Ireland national teams are not regulars at their clubs. Certainly from a Northern Ireland perspective, you look at Kyle Lafferty, who led the campaign, and really he scored 7 goals. If it hadn't been for his goals, Northern Ireland would not have qualified. Yet he played a total of 60 minutes of club football between August and March with Norwich City before getting a loan deal with Birmingham, where he's not even a first team regular there. So that's I think when you start to look at it a wee bit deeper and you do see, well, maybe there is a bit of a lack of quality or a bit of a lack of almost identity in terms of getting those players across and playing at a good level over in England or over in Scotland. And you can kind of see that, you know, as you sort of alluded to earlier on, there's nobody at Arsenal, there's nobody at Liverpool or Chelsea. You know, all these clubs have gone for the more kind of locked, you know, new signings from abroad, and maybe it's just a case of, you know, there might be a slight prejudice almost amongst clubs and amongst guys, you know, Northern Irish football, and you can sort of reflect that with Scottish and Welsh footballers too. Maybe they're just not up to the standard they'd be looking for. And so I think there is definitely a quality issue there. If you look at the numbers, the decline has been pretty drastic, really.
Conor, I'd love to get the Irish perspective. People like Seamus Coleman and Shane Long, who came over for very little money, they came over because they represented really low risk signings at the time, and they've done a great job since they came over. But do you think that in Ireland at the moment that there's a whole load of Seamus Colemans waiting to be found, or is it just that they were one offs and that they're the quality too, the standout examples?
it's really difficult to say, because I mean, Seamus Coleman was essentially found by accident, because he played Gaelic football until he was 20 or 21, and he played with his Sunday league team on the side. That was his second passion, because it wasn't the first sport he wanted to play. So he played for his Sunday league team against Sligo Rovers when he was, I think, 19 or 20. I think maybe he was younger, he could have been 18 or 19. And Sligo, he was the best player on the pitch, and Sligo Rovers signed him up from that, and within like a year he ended up at Everton. So his professional career essentially happened by accident. And he wasn't discovered he wasn't brought through any sort of cohesive scouting or cohesive coaching system. He was an aberration. The problem is, like, I think the way when particularly in Dublin, anyway, the way football is sort of the way football is set up is that there's development leagues. Like, there's the DDSL, which has 5 of the biggest clubs in Dublin, like Cherry Orchard, Home Farm, etc. And those clubs have no link or relation to League of Ireland teams. So what they're trying to do is, and they do very well, is they develop players, and they English clubs then come in and take players from the DDSL teams and bring them across. But what would be better for their development is if there was some sort of link to League of Ireland teams, and maybe instead of going over to England at 15 and 16, they stay in Ireland until they're 18 or 19, finish off school, perhaps start a college degree or whatever, and play League of Ireland football when they're 18 or 19, and then eventually there might be a system place where English clubs have a link with some Irish teams. But for the most part, like, it's happened for centuries, really, for decades, really, is that the likes of Man United and Liverpool and Arsenal and other teams have links to Irish clubs, like development clubs. So they basically take the best pick of these players. And what's happening is a lot of the guys are going over to like United or whoever, and they end up staying in the academy and playing reserve team football until they're 21, 22. And because of the globalization of football right now and the vast quantities of money that Premier League clubs have, if they have an option between signing a player for 20 million from Liga or La Liga or whatever, or bringing through an academy player, invariably they'll go for the big money option because of the vast quantities of money in the Premier League and how easy it is for a team to just capitulate like Aston Villa this season. Clubs aren't willing to take a risk on academy players, a lot of clubs anyway. And I think it's definitely a problem is that these players aren't playing enough football between the ages of, let's say, 17 and 21 at like a decent level, at a competitive level. So I think that's a large problem. But again, there's also this structural issues within Irish football that hardly help the matter.
I'm going to stay with you, Conor, on this. I read about the Dublin District Schoolboys League, which is the largest league of its kind in Europe. I think there's 200 clubs, 16,000 players. Surely, are we saying then, if we step aside from the Premier League for a moment, what about Championship clubs? Should Championship clubs be going over there and saying, I tell you what, I can take a punt on one of these kids that is good enough? Or is it that the 16,000 players aren't receiving good enough coaching? Let's step aside from the Premier League. Let's say that, yes, there's marketing value, you need to appease fans by bringing in a big-name player that, you know, a Seamus Coleman can come in at 16 when no one knows him and maybe he might do something. But what about Championship clubs looking at a 15, 16-year-old who's still in school and saying, I tell you what, he's doing well in that league. Can we not bring him over? Are they missing out on a trick there?
I don't necessarily think they deliberately do this. I think there is, there's a lot of clubs in the Championship and lower leagues who are trying to bring these players across. But a lot of the time, the bigger clubs get in there before them. And because the bigger clubs kind of pay the DDSL clubs more, and because of the allure of playing for a bigger club comes around, like you normally get a situation where the player will end up going to a Premier League club. So I don't think it's for the lack of trying. I do think that in recent times, like a lot of players do think they chase their dream. Essentially, they think that the allure of a Manchester United or a Chelsea or an Arsenal coming in for you, they find that very difficult to turn down, when in actual fact the best thing for the development will probably be to go to a Championship team or a lower league team where you'll get a lot of football and there's more chance of you breaking into the first team. The prime example for me is Dele Alli. Who knows where Dele Alli would be if he had signed for Tottenham when he was 15 or younger. Would he have got his chance? Perhaps he would have, because Pochettino likes to bring through young players, but would he have got his chance the way he did? And would he be where he is now if it wasn't for the kind of hard upbringing he had in lower league football? So I think that's definitely an issue. And also another issue is that I think that players just seem to think that, particularly Irish players, just seem to think that the Premier League is the only place you can play football, and that that's their only dream, and they don't understand that if they go abroad, if they went somewhere else in Europe where they might be a chance of the development. I'm not sure what the demand for Irish players is in Holland or other places. I know that Jack Byrne, who's in the Manchester City Academy, he's on loan at he's been on loan at Camber this season, and he's had a great season in the Eredivisie. But the general rule of thumb with Irish players is that they'll go to English clubs, and they don't see anything beyond English clubs. So I think that's also an issue, is that the development, these players aren't having, they don't have different backgrounds in the development. It's all regimented. It's all pretty much the same. Whereas if you look at even a country the size of Croatia, who have a population of 3 million, which is like a million less than the Republic of Ireland, they look at the players they have. Mm. Look at the players they've produced. And that's, they have players that, like, they have three midfielders at the two biggest clubs in the world, and they have an abundance of other talented players. And that's because these players are going out to different leagues and different countries and experiencing different cultures and different footballing environments. I think that definitely doesn't help with Irish football, is that these players, for the most part, just seem to think that the Premier League is the only option.
Matt, there's Brendan Rodgers said not long ago, a couple of years ago, that one of the big issues that Irish players are facing in Northern Ireland and in Ireland is that they're starting their apprenticeship at 16. And yeah, we all know that the guys coming through the academy systems here in the UK are now at this scouted at 7 or 8. They're in academies at 8 and being coached, you know, 2 or 3 times a week by highly qualified coaches who have got experience of working with players of that age in a structured environment. They're well looked after. Do you think then that's one of the issues in Ireland? And if so, is that because there's a lack of finance or a lack of structure or a bit of both? What can we do in Ireland to resolve that?
I think there's definitely a lack of resources, like certainly here in Northern Ireland, for like grassroots coaching. I think you make a good point that they do seem to start later. I mean, if you look at the League of Ireland at the moment, Paul Heatley's probably the best player by quite a distance. He's only starting to get recognised now, maybe abroad, and he's 27, 28. So it's, you know, it's almost like it's over for him before it's got started. You know, he's not 20, 21. He's 27, 28, and that's too late for, you know, even like a League 1, League 2 club to sort of pick him up. There's definitely a lack of resources over here in Northern Ireland. I think that as well, there's just a lack of confidence and a lack of quality. Really, if you go to Northern Irish club games week in, week out like I do, it is, you're seeing the ball in the air a lot. You're not seeing a great deal of quality. You're not seeing teams that are getting the ball down and passing it around. And that comes back to how players have been coached since they were in their teenage years. I'm not saying certain coaches in Northern Ireland don't have that philosophy. Tommy Breslin with Cliftonville, they won the league 2 years in a row. They were a really attractive side. Won all the plaudits that they really deserved. But it's just a real lack of quality, and it comes back to grassroots coaching.
Yeah, for sure. Colin, anything on that? I mean, obviously you're in Northern Ireland as well. Anything you want to add on that?
Yeah, well, I watch a lot of local game here, and I've been watching it really for nearly 20 years now. And what I would say is that I think over the past 3 or 4 years, whilst I do agree with a lot of what Matt would say, and I mean, certainly you look at a lot of problems, and they would stem from grassroots coaching from a very young age. There's no doubt about that. But I think that certainly at the local level, that the game in the past few years has improved. I think in terms of the coaching, especially in terms of player development, it is getting better. I'm not saying it's perfect, and I'm not saying that it's been done in the exact right way. But I think it has improved. I think that a lot of the football, especially by teams, even at the bottom end of the division, a lot more of it is being played with more emphasis on passing and movement. And you kind of see that translated then into the national team as well. And I think under Nori Sanchez, under Nigel Worthington, you know, a lot of Michael O'Neill's predecessors, the football wouldn't have been pretty to watch. It was rather one-dimensional at times. You know, it was sort of, you kind of just sit back and hope for the best almost. And, you know, a lot of it was based on a long ball game. And to be honest, it was brutal to watch. And I think Connor might agree that the Republic are rather like that at times too.
Yeah, just a little bit.
So I don't think we'll have any arguments there. And again, the problems are mirrored on both sides really. But I think under Michael O'Neill, since he came in the 2012, even when results weren't the best against Azerbaijan and Luxembourg, and when I say not the best, I mean, you look at them and they were absolutely bloody terrible.
It couldn't get any worse at that stage.
I think everybody had thought, like, we'd reach a new low here, things aren't going to get better, and they're just doomed for the next years to continue these failures. But actually, and I did say this at the time, is that despite some of the results, the quality of football, the emphasis on what was going on had certainly changed. It was a lot more progressive. It was a more fluid style of play, and even though that didn't always show in the results, sometimes it did. I mean, they beat Russia, and they drew in Portugal, they drew in Israel. They took points off every single team in that group. They were playing better in some games. It was just a case if it was taking time to implement these changes to kind of make it look like, you know, you can switch between formations depending on the needs and requirements of that game. You know, certain players, in terms of their press and in terms of their shape and structure and their movement off the ball, it was 100 times what it had been previously to that. And that then did begin to show in this most recent qualifying campaign for the Euros. And now I know people will say it wasn't the hardest of groups, but in a way that's irrelevant, because had that been the case before, Northern Ireland would have struggled to win any of those matches against any of those teams. So I think we need to take that into account. And like even the switch in between formations, Michael O'Neill's done, obviously he'd gone through the entire campaign with a reasonably basic 4-4-2 or 4-4-1-1, and then since Chris Brunt's injury, he switched it to a 3-5-2 in some games, and he changed it. But the players seem to know what they're doing. The team's very well drilled. They've only conceded one goal in the last 18 matches in the first half, and I think that's a pretty remarkable record, actually, considering the players that they do have available. Obviously, a very, you know, Gareth McCauley, Johnny Evans, Paddy McNair, Craig Cathcart are top level players in England. But again, beyond that, you know, you're looking at players from Fleetwood Town, from Burnley, from Doncaster, you know, players who've been playing in the lower leagues and getting loan deals out of clubs even lower than that. So you are, you know, in terms of the depth, it's not quite there. But I think what's the case is it has been over the past few years. You know, as I said about players going over to the English academies at a very young age and then getting released at quite a young age, and there's been no sign or indication that that actually helps their development in terms of growing into a player and learning what they should be learning. And I think there's quite a lot of thought now that, you know, you go back to the past, and even the Northern Ireland team of the mid-90s, and you had like the Steve Lomas, Neil Lennon, Michael Hughes, and all those players played for Jim McGilton, all those players started their careers in the Irish League. And what would have happened was that they started off maybe as a 17, 18 year old and were in the team for 2 or 3 years, you know, and the Irish League is quite a rough and tumble league. The pace of it is relatively intense, and you're gonna learn quite a few things about the game. Maybe not so much in terms of improving your skill or ability as you would over in England, but I think certainly in terms of the pace of the game and just learning the tricks of the trade, so to speak. And that helped. Neil Lennon was at Glenavon, Lomas was at Korean, Hughes at Carrick, McGilton at Lisburn Distillery. So they all started off their careers there, and then they got their moves from there. But by the time they moved on to the Premier League clubs, they had already experienced first team football for years. They knew what it was about, and really the transition wasn't too much at all. Whereas you're looking at youth football in England, and whilst, you know, quite a lot of the games are full of skill and ability, you know, there's a massive step up in terms of the pace and intensity and importance of youth team games compared to the first team. And you see that with what Chelsea have done. They've dominated youth team football in England for years. How many of their players have established themselves, not only at Chelsea, but even at Premier League level? There's really not been very many, and I think that's an issue that needs to be addressed as well. But I think in terms of Northern Ireland, I think the case is pretty similar in the Republic, is that there's a lot of new sort of coaching schemes that have been started up. And certainly in Northern Ireland, there's Club NI, who are sort of their scheme that have set up to take in these young teenage players, and from there they then develop them, and then the clubs, the Irish League clubs, would take them from there. And there's been quite a few success stories from that. I know Matt mentioned Paul Heatley at Crusaders, who's probably the league's outstanding player, and whilst he is getting on in years, on the other side of the wing is Gavin White, who's 19. And he only broke into the Crusaders first team squad last season, and he was a revelation. He had trials over in England, and certainly no way at Everton, I think, was at Fulham too, and I think both Glasgow clubs were looking at him too. And that was just a case of, you know, you've come through this system, you've been given first team football at a very young age, and from there you've shown that you can cut it. Maybe not at the same level, but of course not, but you've shown that you have the ability to play first team football and to develop from there. And I think that's important. And you know, I think in terms of both Northern Ireland and the Republic, even like the Republic and Kevin Doyle and Shane Long, James Coleman, they all started their careers at the League of Ireland, you know, and it was from there that they were recognised, rather than 13 or 14 year old kids being picked up playing youth team football over here, you know. So I think that's a big thing. And even Dele Alli was mentioned earlier, but I think Connor mentioned him. And you look at the England team now and the makeup of it, and so many of those players have now come through, you know, the lower league structures. You know, obviously the likes of Jamie Vardy as well, you know, these meteoric rises. But they played football for years, and it was just really a case of working themselves up. And if you have the talent and the ability, you will you will be spotted and you will get your break. And it was even the same, a couple of examples from one man, Gareth McCauley, who played for three Irish league clubs before being picked up by Lincoln. And then from there, you know, he's obviously moved on to Leicester and then West Brom. So you do have these success stories. It's just really a case of, obviously, the clubs need to be scouting over here in the first place and recognising that, like, you know, there's very, like, in terms of Irish League of Ireland players, it's very, very cheap. You're talking probably, you know, five-figure sums. It would almost be odd for six-figure sums to be labelled at Irish League players, even, you know, the very top bracket. So it's very cheap in terms of the market. It's just a case of getting your scouting right and identifying the talent that is there.
Connor, I had a chat with John Townsend, who writes for the site, and when he graduated from university out in the States, he was offered the chance to go into the MLS draft. He would have joined an MLS club on a rookie contract, which is, you know, $25,000 a year, which is a lot less than what he would have made just going into the city or something, actually putting his degree to use. The average annual salary for a Premier Division player is €16,000. So are we seeing players who are getting to the age of sort of 16, 17, saying, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to make it, you know, talented players saying, I don't know if I'm going to make it, I don't know if I want to risk it, or coming out of university and saying, I think I'm just going to go and get a job that pays me more. Is that a problem?
Yeah, that's definitely an issue. There's also the twin issue of the GAA and rugby. Because in the last like 15 years, pretty much since rugby union went professional, the growth of the sport has been massive in Ireland, and you now have four provinces who are professional outfits. They compete at the top level of their sport. The Irish team, you know, the Irish team is competing in the top level of its sport, and it's now very glamorous for guys to go and pursue that. Like, I mean. The academy system in rugby over here is really, really good, particularly in Leinster anyway. A lot of guys will play maybe three or four different sports, and when they get to 15 or 16, it's probably time to it's when most guys try to focus on one rather than keep on playing all of them. And a lot of time, because of particularly outside of Dublin and like in rural Ireland, the GAA is such a massive community thing that a lot of players will invariably stick with the GAA because it's such a parochial thing, and they might give up playing football. And I think there's so many players being lost over the years to other sports just because, like, it's either they have more of a passion for the other sport or it's just easier to make it in other sports. I mean, you have to think about it. Like, it's to make it as an elite footballer is a very, very rare thing. It's the percentage of it compared to other sports is minute. So, like, there is definitely a risk factor involved. But again, like, there's a lot of Irish players who go to England when they're 15 and 16 as well, and they don't make it, and they end up back here. Either they'll play League of Ireland football or they'll just give up the game completely. There's been countless stories of it over the years. Like, I have a couple of mates, like, who went abroad. They went to England when they were, what, 16 or 17. One of the lads in particular ended up, like, he was in the Celtic Academy, I think. He ended up playing a little bit for Aberdeen. And he's now back here, and like, he's basically he played a little bit of the League of Ireland football, but he's just stopped playing now because he's in his mid 20s, and he just decided it was time to get a proper job. And it's sad because when he was like 15 or 16, everyone just thought this guy was going to be a professional footballer, that it's going to be our mate who's playing in the Irish team, like. But you know, it didn't work out for him. And there's countless stories like that. I think it's just there's less of a risk either playing other sports or, as you're saying, gone and just cut straight on a college degree and then, you know, getting an ordinary job from it.
Obviously, with finance being one of the issues, Matt, is it a case that, you know, there aren't sponsors coming into the League of Ireland, so as a result, you know, you're never going to pay the same wages, which is fine. Certainly not sponsors on the same level as England. You can't even compare the two. Are we saying then that if we can improve the base quality of the league itself, the players coming through the system, as Colin said, that the standard has actually risen in the last few years. If we can improve the base quality of the leagues, will that help bring in sponsors to then reinvest that money into the academy and produce players of a better standard? And ultimately, when you're selling players on for money, which, you know, all these players are going to want to move on to another level eventually, is that the way to keep the league sustainable, Matt?
Yeah, I think it is. I think if the quality is there, then naturally investment will come in, there'll be more money, you can sell players on for higher prices, and obviously it benefits the league as a whole. I just think that it all comes down to the quality and coaching. It needs to start from a very early age, as you've already said. And, you know, players in Northern Ireland don't play for a lot of money. They're really not getting a lot of wages. You know, they're training a couple of nights a week. They're playing because they love to play football. And I think, you know, in a way that does sort of make the league in Northern Ireland quite fashionable in a way, because they are playing because they love football. They're not playing for a great deal of money, even though ultimately that is their dream, that they want to, you know, they want to play for Manchester United or Manchester City or Arsenal or whatever and earn, you know, the sort of wages that Wayne Rooney's getting. But it all comes down to improving the base quality, as you said, and naturally investment and more money will come into it from there, because really the resources, certainly in Northern Ireland at the moment, I mean, I know Colin said that things have been improving in recent years, but it's still not anywhere near the standard of England. So yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, Colin, if I could just interject there for a sec. The problem in the Republic of Ireland, anyway, is that like the league itself was controlled by the clubs until about 10 years ago, and then the FAI, like the Football Association of Ireland, bought it out and took it over. But it's basically been like the ugly child in the corner that they don't care about, the black sheep of the family. They just like there is very little investment in the league, and like there's such a, if you go to the League of Ireland games, the supporters of every club, there's such a vitriolic hatred of the FAI for the way they've treated the league. And the problem is like it's just like John Delaney, the CEO of the FAI, he talks a good game. Like he talks about how the state of the organization is in rude health, and the development plan is in place and stuff like that. But like the league itself, the winner of the League of Ireland, just in terms of prize money, gets 200. I think it's 200 or 250 grand. John Delaney, the CEO of the FAI, gets paid 350 grand a year. So he earns 100,000 more than the first place team in the league. It's just mind-boggling. And this guy, he hasn't given an interview with, he hasn't given a press conference to the Irish media in 4 years. The only interviews he's done is with selected media partners. He is one of the big, if not the biggest problem with Irish football. I hate to make it as simplistic as that, but he really is a crook. And the guy.
Are you actually saying that a governing body lacks transparency?
Yeah, I'm not the leader. Yeah, I'm not the leader in question. Has a bit of a dictator complex. This is the lack of self awareness that John Delaney has. He did an interview on Irish radio last year in which he slammed Sepp Blatter and then like took the mick out of Sepp Blatter because they made what was that FIFA movie, Uniting Passions? Is that the movie?
With Tim Roth.
So John Delaney was taking the piss out of Sepp Blatter for authorizing a FIFA movie, and I like the presenter of the show was like, "Oh, that's incredible ego, John, isn't it? That's incredible ego." Well, it turns out like 6 months previous, the Irish Independent, who is run by Dennis O'Brien, who pays for half of the Irish manager's salary, made a documentary about John Delaney, painting him in just wonderful light. And they didn't get a football journalist or a sports reporter to interview John Delaney. They got their entertainment expert to interview John Delaney. And it's just, I'll try and find it and send it on to you later. It's just the most delusional piece of footage I've ever seen. Like, It's basically like Triumph of the Will Part 2.
Connor, is this a guy who took a dodgy £5 million payment from FIFA after
he inadvertently disclosed this information in that same interview. Like he accidentally let it slip that the FBI had received like an illicit payment of $5 million to keep quiet about the playoff defeat to France in 2009.
What an idiot.
Sorry about that tangent, lads, but yeah,
funnily enough, I was actually gonna mention him, and I was gonna ask you how big a problem he is, because everyone I seem to speak to about the Irish game says that this guy's a serious problem. Like, I mean, everyone seems to have a laugh about him and says he's a bit of a clown, he's a bit of an idiot, but actually he genuinely is an obstacle as well.
Yeah, he's a huge obstacle, and the problem is he's built up a structure of power around them in which he's essentially unremovable, because they like the board the way the FAI board, now this is just from what I've read, like the way the FAI board is structured is that they I think if you reach the age of 65, you have to retire your place on the board and give it up to a new member. It's just to keep, originally it was meant to keep the board fresh and have new ideas and stuff, but John Delaney raised the age of the board member's retirement to, I think it's 70. So there's about four or five guys currently on the board who are pushing 65. So they're all loyal supporters of John Delaney. So he's raised it. So the next time an election comes around, he's got these guys on side.
Yeah.
So it's just like it's a very, very modern thing. I think it's a bit like what Mike Ashley's done at Newcastle. He's just like, he's pushed away any kind of transparency. He's pushed away any idea of keeping reporters involved and stuff. And most of the guys, like I won't mention names, but I've talked to a few like of the biggest Irish football journalists about this in private, and they all like think he's just a crook. So I won't mention names. But they You can have a guess like who the various people are, but they all think he's a crook anyway.
I think we could talk about some of that stuff, and certainly the league stuff, player development stuff. We'll try and arrange another podcast, maybe take some people's questions and tackle it specifically. I wanted to talk about the national teams ahead of the Euros. I'll fire this one at Colin and Matt, whoever wants to take it first. Northern Ireland in a tricky group: Germany, Poland, Ukraine. Do you think they can get out of it?
Yes, I actually do. and this might look extremely foolish in a month's time, but I do. I am optimistic. And the reason being, it is a tough group. You've got Germany, you see Germany, Poland, Ukraine. There's no weak team there. But there's never going to be a weak team. I mean, Northern Ireland with the fourth seeds. You're always going to get a big hitter. That happens to be Germany, who will almost certainly go through with ease. So then you're looking at Poland and Ukraine, and bear in mind there will probably be three teams progresses from the group, so that actually opens things up quite a lot. And Poland, Ukraine, first of all, let's look at Poland. They obviously have Robert Lewandowski, who's an absolutely outstanding striker. I don't think anybody could argue about that. And I saw a couple of their group games. Obviously, they were involved in the group with the Republic of Ireland and Scotland in qualifying. And whilst, yes, they did have a few good results, there wasn't anything actually there. If you can keep a hold on Lewandowski, and I know that's a big if, there's not too much there to worry about, I don't think. And the same goes with Ukraine. I mean, I don't think they're bad teams per se, but if you're looking at them against Northern Ireland in one-off matches, I don't really see there's any reason why Northern Ireland can't sneak one victory. And actually, the recent record against Poland is quite good. Now, they haven't played them in a few years, but there have certainly been a couple of victories over the past few years. And they beat them 3-2 at Windsor Park at the last home game they played, and they drew 1-1 in Poland. So there's a bit of history between the teams. And Northern Ireland has that record. They've actually beaten Poland more times than they've lost to them. And again, with Ukraine, there's maybe not quite the stardust there has been with them in recent years. Obviously, there's no Shevchenko anymore. Conor Pienka is a fantastic player, and Yarmolenko as well. But I mean, I don't think there's too much to fear. I mean, because you're at the Euros, there's always going to be good teams. You know, you're not going to have an easy ride, especially if you're a fourth seed. So I think they could get away with that group with a one win and one draw. which would be enough to see them through either in second or third place. And realistically, that would be a massive, massive, massive success story. But I don't think it's overly unrealistic. I think they do have a chance. And Northern Ireland traditionally have been a team that have played well in the big occasion. And you know, they can raise their game as well. You certainly see that with the players. And that's traditionally what's been the problem, is the struggle with the so-called lesser teams. So I actually think that what history would show, and the actual team they have now, I mean, they're unbeaten in 10 matches, and they're on very, very good run of form. I don't see why there's any reason why they can't get out. I don't think anybody would be overly surprised if they don't. But an optimistic, but it's not unrealistic view is that they do finish second or third.
Matt, you wrote about Michael O'Neill.
Yeah.
Was on The Guardian. Great piece. Talk to me a bit about O'Neill and where he will succeed or fail in this tournament, and who you think the key men will be.
I think in terms of O'Neill, like, I just think Northern Ireland owe O'Neill a massive debt. Like, this guy has come in 2012, as Colin said. Results weren't going well from at the start. It sort of looked like it was going to go in a similar direction to, you know, maybe Nigel Worthington or Laurie Sanchez, and just be a same old Northern Ireland kind of story, you know. But it hasn't happened like that. I think Michael O'Neill, he's a great manager. I think if you look at the key man in the qualifying campaign was Kyle Lafferty. Well, his transformation was down to Michael O'Neill. He was sent off in a game against Portugal. Michael O'Neill sat him down, laid out some harsh truths, said simply, you know, you can't nail down a place at whatever club you're at. You're not going to nail down a place in the national team if you keep playing like that, if you lack discipline, if you lack dedication. And there is a sort of perception of Kyle Lafferty as there's a hard-working side to him, and when he brings that side out, he can be a great footballer, he can score a lot of goals. There's also the other half that he's a bit of a clown, he's a bit of a messer, and he lacks a work ethic. But under Michael O'Neill, he's really shown the better side of him, and that's reflected in his performances. I mean, 7 goals in the qualifying campaign, he was absolutely instrumental in getting Northern Ireland to the Euros. I think what Michael O'Neill has done is he's actually instilled a togetherness in the Northern Ireland side, and he's implemented a tactical flexibility. They can play with 3 at the back, they can play with 4. You know, they've proven they can play with wing backs. I think that's crucial when you're going to come into the Euros and you're going to be playing against 3 very different sides. It's not one-dimensional with Northern Ireland anymore. They actually have options. They have quality. They have players who are not only have a self-belief, they have a belief in what O'Neill has been telling them. And I think that's very important. And as Colin said, they're unbeaten in 10 matches. Defensive record is absolutely outstanding. And yeah, they don't have a fear. They're fearless. They're not actually scared to play the bigger teams anymore. They actually relish the opportunity to show their quality, and I just think that's magnificent.
Colin, how do you think they'll set up?
Well, as I said, Matt sort of said there as well, you know, the sort of switch between 4-4-2 and 3-5-2. I think Michael O'Neill sort of, you know, trying to think 3-5-2 is how we're probably going to have to go with quite a lot of the games during the tournament. Obviously, you've got Macaulay, Evans, Cathcart as 3 centre halves, and then to play with 2 wing backs. And I think that's pretty much just to make sure that you're completely, you're shaped completely solid, you know, you've consolidated things, and they offer some sort of a goal threat as well. I think there will be a goal threat there. I mean, that's probably the way, but I don't think, as I mentioned earlier about the defensive record, I don't think anybody's, you know, gonna give them a walloping, so to speak. You know, I think they're pretty much got the structure right, and as Matt said, well, about confidence. You know, what Northern Ireland got to lose here? Absolutely nothing. You know, nobody had any sort of expectations for them. They could lose all 3 matches and nobody would be surprised. They'd have everything to gain, and sort of the format of the tournament is very much designed to give these sorts of teams a chance to, you know, to progress to the next stage. And I think if you look at it that way, there's certainly reasons to be positive. I think 3-5-2 is how they're going to shape up. But again, Steve Davis, the captain and the outstanding player, is absolutely crucial in terms of his fitness and his, obviously he's got his form at the minute. So if they can keep him fit, I think everything sort of revolves around him. And if he plays well, Northern Ireland tend to play well. His importance can't be understated.
He really is, like Stephen Davis, you can't overstate his importance. Obviously, he's the captain and he's the heartbeat. I mean, I agree with what Colin's saying. Stephen Davis has played, he's played in the Premier League, he's played for Rangers, but I think the last year he's really played the football of his life. Like, I really think he's been absolutely outstanding, even for Southampton, some of his performances. Even chipping in with the odd goal, he's never been known as a midfielder who scores a lot of goals, but it's just shown in his confidence that has come from, he would be one of the first players down in the team sheet for Ronald Koeman. It's the exact same for Michael O'Neill, obviously, as the captain. I just think having Stephen Davis fit and in the middle there is absolutely crucial.
Yeah, I think the thing with Davis as well, and it's kind of the case of Oliver Norwood on a smaller scale, but they're two technically outstanding players.
Yeah.
And I think, as I said, the game, in terms of the Northern Ireland's progression, they keep the ball so well. They're very smart and they know exactly what they're doing, and everything goes through them. Not just that, but they provide both a danger from a set pieces as well in terms of their delivery and even their aerial presence. Steve Davis scored the crucial third goal against Greece, which really capped the qualification. That was from a corner as well. And Norwood, his set pieces. It's very, both those players, and Oliver Norwood plays for Reading in the Championship, but I actually think he's been outstanding for Northern Ireland. And technically, there's no question regarding them. So I think if everything goes through them, they've got them both fit, and that sort of allows transition between defence and attack, and that's going to be absolutely crucial, because pretty much every game is going to have to be played on the counter-attack. So if they can get it right, Northern Ireland do have a chance.
How big a miss is Chris Brunt? Can he be replaced?
I think he can. I think Chris Brunt's an outstanding player, and I actually don't think he gets a lot of love in the media. I think he's pretty underrated, actually. But that's more his club form for West Brom, who's been outstanding for years. But for Northern Ireland, there's always been doubts about Chris Brunt and his commitment to Northern Ireland. I actually think quite a lot of those doubts are harsh, to be honest. But I think he was sort of in squads under Nigel Worthington when there was a lot of sort of question marks around a number of players in terms of their commitment to the cause and if they really wanted to be playing for Northern Ireland, in terms of it's sort of like this is a lost cause, and the team morale wasn't great. There wasn't really any sort of leadership from above to give them an incentive to play. So there was always a question mark regarding that. I actually think he was effective in the last campaign. He played at left fullback most of the time, and he's got a brilliant left foot. He's got a good attitude, and he does have the ability. And he's never been one of Northern Ireland's most important players. He's only ever scored one goal for the national team, and that was against San Marino about 8 years ago. So he's never really had a massive impact, or the impact that people certainly thought he could have. So whether or not it does, and again, that's a reason behind the formation switch to 3-5-2. I think what they're trying to do is, like, there's no replacement for him at left fullback, really, and probably Daniel Lafferty would be the next one, and he hasn't been getting first team football for Burnley. So what they've done is the 3-5-2, the two wing backs, and have Stuart Dallas playing over on the left hand side, and he's had a fantastic couple of years. I moved to Leeds United, where he's been very effective, and before that he was at Brentford. Yeah. And for the national team as well, he's been another massive, massive success story. And he was actually one of the success stories of the Irish League as well. He recently got a move from Crusaders over to Brentford, which really started it all off. So he's another one that they've come through under Michael O'Neill and have really developed alongside, obviously, the club form. But he's integrated them into the team. They've had an impact in terms of goals and assists as well. So again, that's another kind of way in which they've evolved both tactically and in personnel.
In one word, guys, Colin, Matt, I'll stick this to you as well, Connor. Will Northern Ireland get out of the group? Colin?
Yes.
Matt?
No.
Connor?
Yeah, I think they will.
All right, great. Let's jump over to the Republic. Now, that is a tough group. I think that, Belgium are much, much fancied. I've never been too impressed by them when I watch them play. I think they're kind of like England were in... sort of between 2002 and 2006, they don't really have a defined style.
At the World Cup, they were supposed to sort of set it on fire, and it didn't really happen. It didn't really happen like that. I mean, they sort of scraped victories, but I was kind of watching them going, "Eh, like, is this what everybody's been shouting about? Like, they have such an amazing squad."
Yeah, and it's a strange. I sent a message to my friend the other day with their defenders and keepers. Courtois had a terrible season. Mignolet, you never know what you're going to get. He's brilliant sometimes. He looks like an amateur other times. Kompany's a big miss. I think Alderweireld and Vertonghen are solid players. But if you look at that back line, you know, people like Dedrick Boyata, who couldn't really cut it at Manchester City. They don't have fullbacks, and they got Vermaelen in the squad still. He's hardly getting games.
Is this golden generation of Belgian players? They've just forgot to create any fullbacks.
So Connor, do you think that Ireland? I think Italy will be better than people think. Conte solid. Sweden with Ibrahimovic. How do you think Ireland will do in that group?
This is probably blind optimism, but I think we'll get out of the group. I think that again, the game of real importance is the first one against Sweden and the Stade de France. We've played Sweden in previous qualifying campaigns, and they are literally just Ibrahimovic, and I hate diminishing a team down to one player, but they are essentially just a vehicle for Ibrahimovic. So if he's on form, we'll probably get beaten. But if we win that game, I fancy to go through, because I think we'll get at least a point against Belgium. Because as you guys were saying, I really have never been impressed by them. I think Wilmots is a weak coach. I think that they're a very one-dimensional, one-paced team. They play a lot of nice possession football, but a lot of the time it's just in front of teams, and you get the sense that, Hazard has started to come back to form for Chelsea recently, and he's had a decent last couple of months for Belgium. But when he's played, but a lot of the time he flatters to deceive for Belgium. De Bruyne is always excellent for Belgium. He's probably the best player at the moment. But a lot of these players who we see at club level who are outstanding don't tend to do it at international level, and I tend to believe that's to do with the coach.
Of individuals more than a team, really.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't seem to be able to put a stamp on the team and get a system that works for the players he has. But I do think Ireland will get out of the group, but I did say that before the last Euros, and that ended in despair and misery. But I suppose this time we don't have a coach who names his team 5 days before a match, so everyone can see it. I think the Italians, I would expect to top the group, because despite the struggles they've had recently, and they've lost half their midfield at the moment, Marchisio and Verratti out injured. I do think they're always a team at tournaments that just take it onto another level. And before Verratti's injury, I actually would have tipped them to get to a semi-final or final. So I think the Italians will top the group. But I think, particularly now, there's this best third place team that goes through. Ireland could easily be one of them, and depending on the Sweden result, they beat Sweden, they essentially just need 1 point in the last two games to go through.
That Ireland-Italy game has got all the hallmarks of an absolute grind, I reckon. It could be properly the tactical battle of the group.
Hopefully a gentleman's agreement beforehand that we play a draw so both teams go through. That'll do nicely.
Connor, who do you think the key men are?
I think it's definitely been proven in the last qualifying campaign how much of a catalyst John Walters is. So Walters hasn't played recently, he's been out injured. I think he's just coming back to fitness now, so he is essential to the way Ireland play, because he's the one who leads the pressing. He's the one who kind of sets the tone for the rest of the team. I think in recent months, Shane Long has stepped up to the mark big time for Southampton, and before the Germany game, even last year, which when he scored the winner and he came off the bench, he wasn't a regular for the Irish team. Like Martin O'Neill, I don't know if Martin O'Neill didn't trust him, or he just didn't see a way to fit him into his team, or that he just preferred to bring him on as a late impact sub. But in the last few months, bearing in mind all the injuries we've had, like Robbie Keane is 35 now, and he's just come back to fitness after a knee operation. So really the only option is playing Shane Long, and he's our best striker by a distance. So I think the key players are definitely Long, Walters. I think Wes Hoolan, we tend to play like a 4-4-1-1 against lesser teams, and Wes Hoolan plays just off the striker, but O'Neill has tended to play a more defensive team against better opposition, so he'll try. I would say Wes Hillon, there's every chance Wes Hillon won't play, but he is
still can't believe only... Wes Hillon's 33.
Yeah, he yeah. looks about 20. he's maybe he's Benjamin Button, lads.
He's got something but, going on there.
Yeah, but he the thing about Wes Hillon is like he O'Neill for a long time didn't trust him in big games, but he played him against Germany and he's the only Irish player who seems to have to keep the ball. So I think and that also the problem is if Wes Hillon doesn't play, it'll be a midfield three of Glenn Whelan, James McCarthy and Jeff Hendrick. And the problem with Whelan and McCarthy playing the same team is that Whelan occupies the anchor in midfield role, which is where McCarthy is best. Irish teams, Irish managers, particularly I think Trapattoni in his last campaign and many pundits on Irish TV seem to think that James McCarthy is some sort of Roy Keane style player who plays box to box. He's far, far better as a you know, a player who dictates the tempo at the base of a midfield. So, the best midfield structure for Ireland is having James McCarthy as the anchor midfielder. You have Wes Hillon as a 10, and you have Jeff Hendrick as the box to box player, because Jeff Hendrick has a bit of explosiveness and a lot of energy. So, I think that those would be the key players. I think defensively, it'll be interesting to see how Ireland shape up, because John O'Shea is the captain. He's been there a long, long time, but in recent games, Kieran Clark and Richard Keogh have played together and they've played very, very well. So that's an interesting dilemma. But defensively, I think Ireland are pretty solid, as long as we don't play Shea Given in goal.
so you think the goals will be the problem? I think they only conceded, what, six or seven in qualifying. So, yeah, they were definitely solid. Yeah. But when you come up against a team like Italy, it's essentially going to be how you attack, because They are going to be solid at the back, and they're probably not going to have runners going in behind as much. You know, Eddie is a pretty decent nippy player, but I think that Italy will be the key game. I think it will actually come up to the Italy game for me personally, because Sweden and Belgium, you never know what you're going to get. So you don't actually know what the situation is going to be by the time you get to Italy. I think they'll need a result by the time they get there. But how much does the goal scoring worry you, Connor?
Yeah, it definitely worries me, because I think we've had this issue for a long, long time. When Robbie Keane doesn't play or Robbie Keane doesn't score, we don't normally tend to score. So Long has chipped in with some important goals recently, and I do think that the game plan for Ireland will be to either nick a goal from a set piece or get a goal on the break through Shane Long's pace and then hopefully hold out. I tend to agree with you in that we'll go down to the last game, but I kind of fear Sweden more than I fear Belgium. And I know that sounds absolutely ludicrous, but just because I think that Sweden are the type of team who will be happy to just give us the ball and play deep and hope that they can nick a goal through something brilliant from Ibrahimovic. And we're not very, very good when we're given the ball and we're given the ascendancy in a game. We're much, much better when we're playing against a team who have lots and lots of possession, which allows us to kind of play in the break and just play defensively. I do think it'll probably go down to the Italian game, but either way, I'd take that before the tournament anyway.
Chaps, in one word again, Colin, Ireland's qualify?
I think it's the same situation with Northern Ireland. I actually think they will, just about, but they will.
Connor?
Unquestionably.
Are you having your coffee? Are you having your morning coffee?
Huh?
Are you having your morning coffee? Matt?
No.
I think they'll do it, yeah.
It's interesting, because it seems like Ireland seems to be a little bit less clear-cut than Northern Ireland. Like, Matt, you were certain they're not going to go through. Colin, you're certain they're going to go through. Whereas Ireland, everyone seems to be... Yeah, Connor, you seem to be pretty optimistic, but I don't...
Yeah.
Is that because of the teams they're up against?
I don't know. I think the Republic of Ireland have a slightly tougher group. I think they're both tough groups. I think the Republic is slightly the worst of the two to be in. But again, the problem I have with the Republic of Ireland squad is that they don't have too much of an identity in terms of their playing style, and they seem a bit of a mismatch of players. Whereas I look at Northern Ireland and there's more of a shape. You know who's going to be in the starting 11 nine times out of ten. It's very clear. It's very structured. With the Republic, it does seem a little bit odd almost in terms of I'm looking at their squad now, and what actually strikes me is how old quite a lot of the players are. You know, and you sort of mentioned there about Wes Hillen being 33, but there's quite a number of players there that are over the age of 30. Even you look at their attackers, Robbie Keane 35, Kevin Doyle 32, Shane Long's 29, which is actually surprising me, Jonathan Walters 32, and Dal Murphy 33. You know, none of these players, you know, well, they're all getting on, and you almost kind of think this might be for a lot of them their last chance at a major tournament. Whereas maybe the public fan teams of a few years gone by, you've had the likes of the Shea Given, Richard Dunn, you know, Robbie Keane up front, but you had these star players, and you knew who was going to be playing most of the time. But now it seems to be a bit of a collection, you know, of you know, players who are a bit part in the Premier League and the Championship. But whenever I've watched them as well, I think in terms of quality, they have more quality and more resources than Northern Ireland do. But I'm not sure if it's particular, and Connor will know better than me, like how well it's actually that translates into performances and results. I think they had a tough qualifying group. I think they got slightly lucky in terms of getting through the playoffs as comfortably as they did. But at the same time, I think they do have, you know, it's Northern Ireland in the group, that they only really need one win, and you might need an extra draw there too for insurance. But it's a tough group. But as I said, I think they'll do it. It's just a case of they're a harder team to gauge, in my opinion. They could turn up and they could be very impressive, or they could turn up and, you know, be a total letdown, really, as they were 4 years ago. And obviously, again, they had a tough group then. But it was just a case of, you know, I as far as I was concerned, they just didn't turn up. The quality might not be there, but again, there's a couple of question marks around in the actual commitment to some of the players and how much they really want to be part of the team. And of course, Martin O'Neill being there, I think he's more of a man manager than Giovanni Trapattoni was. There's no question about that. But at the same time, those question marks remain for me for this particular squad that they have.
Connor, do you agree with that?
Yeah, that's been an issue for many, many years, is the lack of identity or lack of idea as to what way we're playing. And I think O'Neill's tried to change that in recent times, but it's a cultural thing. Like it's been a systemic problem for so long that it'll take a massive overhaul to change it. But yeah, I think like there's a lot of players over the age of 30, and what strikes me about the squads is like how many players in the initial squad Ireland named. Like O'Neill named 35 players. It's like 10 of these or 12 of these aren't going to go. I don't really see the benefit of it, apart from maybe keeping a few guys on their toes. But I think that that is probably one concern. Like, I mean, I think it is a last chance selection for quite a few players. I'd say, yeah, like Robbie Keane, John O'Shea, these guys will probably all retire after the tournament. And but yeah, there's a few other younger guys who've been given a chance under O'Neill that wouldn't necessarily have got a chance under, well, would definitely not have got a chance under Trapattoni. So I don't think it's all doom and gloom.
Okay, guys, thanks so much for joining us. I reckon we could talk about Irish football, not just the Euros, but player development and stuff like that for 3 or 4 hours. To be honest, we could just sit here all day and talk about it. We'll definitely arrange another podcast in the future. But Colin Miller, Connor Kelly and Matt Gault, thanks so much for joining us. That was the Lob podcast. We'll be back again with another Irish football one sometime soon, hopefully. In the meantime, take care and thanks for listening.